Hey, you're listening to The Morning Show with Aaron, and I did mention I'd seen Lisa pull up outside, and yes, our councillor Lisa Thompson here in the studio. Welcome back.
Kia ora, thank you. It's lovely to be home, actually.
Yeah, and yeah, when I say welcome back, not just to the studio, but welcome back to the land.
That's exactly right.
Yes, the country.
I was fortunate enough to go to the UK and Italy for 3.5 weeks, which I felt very privileged to do, and we got back last Tuesday, actually. It was the first time I'd been back since 1999, because okay. I actually lived and worked in London for 2.5 years.
You'd have a different perspective on the world now. You're a councillor here. I don't know what you were doing back 20 years ago, 25 years ago, but do you see that? Do you see England and Wales as it differently through different eyes?
What I was quite... What really struck me when we arrived, we drove from Heathrow, obviously, up to Wales, was just the abundance of vegetation, the trees. Like, I forgot, you know, you think of London as a big city that's just a concrete jungle, but as you're driving up the M4, just that abundance of fully established trees in all of the paddocks, and then going into Wales and seeing exactly the same. And then we did a lot of walking while we were in Wales, and there's the city like Cardiff and all of the other towns, but everywhere you go where the disused railway tracks are now all cycle walkways and just trees everywhere.
Right. So has that been a big change over the last sort of few decades in Wales, which was
My partner said
traditionally a mining source of coal for the UK.
Yeah, well, we stayed with my partner's sister and husband in what was the family house. So my partner, you know, could look out the window, and he said when he was growing up and, 50 years ago, the hills that he pointed to, they were black. So that was from the coal mining.
Those were black. I thought you were going to say they had no trees.
No, and they had no trees. And where there were open fields that you could see for miles, because they were also free-flowing paddocks for stock, for sheep and cattle, where you used to be able to see right through are now tree-lined and quite green. We spent a week in Italy as well with my partner's good friends who have done up an old farmhouse, so they're in Tuscany. And again, just the abundance of forest everywhere, and ancient cypresses and, you know, the olive groves and all of that.
Like in Europe, because they've had the population is denser and the effects of civilization, you know, the negative effects have got strong sooner and earlier than they have here, that they're now further out the other side of repairing what's been done?
I couldn't comment on that, but
sort of feels because, like it.
Yeah, I guess because they're still concentrated in their villages. Like when we were in Tuscany, you know, just up the hill, literally like half a K up the hill, was a small community called Lipiano, which is a different region, and they're very, I guess, rohe orientated, even though they might be half a K up the road. And so Lipiano, for example, is a small hilltop village with its own castle, but it's very much its own identity, where people have been there for generations. And then another 10 minutes down the road at Montirchi, another bigger hilltop village with a castle, you know, because they are fortified and they're hundreds of years old. People have lived there for generations. And so you've got that physical and intergenerational connection, very much like here for Māori.
Yeah, I was just thinking that. Yeah.
You know, you've got your marae and then your hapu in the area that you connect to. So that really struck me about the abundance of the vegetation. And then, of course, the skinny roads in Wales.
Oh, yeah.
And people have way smaller cars. If you know, we were like, oh, look, there's a Ford. Oh, it's a Hilux. You know, when you saw the trucks, which aren't like here in New Zealand where every second vehicle is a four-wheel drive. Over there, people are driving lots of European cars, so they're much smaller because in most towns or villages, there's very little parking. And in fact, there's hardly any because the streets are so skinny. We went to a place called St. David's, which is the smallest big city in Wales, it's known as, because it's got a cathedral and a saint.
Oh, so it gets to call itself a city.
Yeah. And that's a seaside village, and it was packed, and the weather wasn't that nice. But the parking is out of town, and you have to pay for it. So everywhere you go, you have to pay for your parking. And another place we went to, Ramsey Island, and they've got there, there's only probably 10 spaces for public parking, and then you have to park in a paddock, and you have to pay for the parking. And there was an old guy, and he was, it was so funny, it was so cute. He was sitting in his car, and then on top of his roof, he had this old transistor radio with a fork in it for an aerial, and he was listening to 80s disco music. I think we had a chat to him. Talked about rugby and things like that. And then he said that he was in like a Freemasons organisation. He just celebrated last Thursday his 50 years of being a volunteer.
Right.
And so he was there as a volunteer on the weekend to take the money from visitors for parking.
So that, like you were saying to me off the air, it sounds like they're okay with the idea that you park outside town and walk around in
town.
It's
just what you do. That's just what you have to do. And another thing that really struck me in Wales was the bilingualism. Mm. Everything was in Welsh first and then in English second. So road signage, the old road signage is in English first and then Welsh second, but as they replace them, they're in Welsh first and English second.
So do you hear much, is it like here in our country where you're starting to hear the indigenous language more? Because Welsh is, but maybe people don't know, but Wales was invaded by the English, just the same as happened here.
And they almost lost their language, and then there was a revitalisation of Welsh.
So do you hear it being spoken?
All the time. You go on the train, and the announcements are first in Welsh, and then they are in English.
Wow.
And all of the information boards, Welsh, English. You go in shops, Welsh, English. And I'm not sure what the percentage of fluent Welsh speakers are. My partner isn't a first speaker of Welsh, but he can speak it. But friends of his grew up with their first language as Welsh.
Really? That's fascinating. Because the thing with Aotearoa is that there were still people, there were older Māori people still around who were first language Māori speakers.
My mother was a first language Māori speaker.
When the movement to revitalise the language began, so there were people that you could go to. But I would have thought in Wales, I don't know, did it survive that way as natural speakers?
No, it's everywhere.
Well, they just had to work really hard.
Yeah, it's everywhere.
Now it's everywhere.
Yeah, and that's that was really cool about that. And no one was getting lost on the M4, the M5, you know, because you had two languages displayed. You know, you choose which part.
Oh, yeah, because we've had that. Oh, yeah, we've had that stupid comment here from some idiot politician.
Might get lost, or they won't understand it. And those that don't have a Welsh name and an English name are either in, you know, if it's just a Welsh name and there's not an English name to it, it's just Welsh.
Hey, so from like, and I know you got sick as soon as you came back, so you weren't at the last community board meeting. So I'm not going to ask you a lot of details about what's happening. But what I kind of interested in is, you know, you go overseas and you leave a lot of your stuff behind, but I'm interested if there were any issues or things about your work or about the community that stayed in your mind when you were overseas. Because that's a bit of an... I was hoping there'd be like one or two things that would be an indicator of what's is important to you and things like that.
Well, you never... I don't think you ever really switch off from your work. And, you know, 3.5 weeks is a long time away. But I knew in council that it was a lighter workload. And, you know, with the long-term plan considerations and other things that are going on in our communities, that, you know, there are other councillors. And also, you know, Dennis Amor does such a great job in terms of being the chair of the community board. He's on top of lots of things that are happening locally. Mm. So, you know, so those sorts, you know, your worries are sort of eased in that. But, you know, you come back to work ready to get back into work other than being a bit sick.
Yeah.
You know, so we went back full on Monday because we had our policy and regulatory hearings for the Freedom Camping bylaw review. So we had that on Monday, which was it Monday or Tuesday? on Tuesday, actually.
Tuesday, yeah.
Yep. So we had obviously the Raglan Community Board. Dennis spoke to their submission. There were a lot of Raglan submissions on many aspects of the proposed changes in our bylaw.
Interesting. So it's still definitely a hot enough topic that people are submitting.
Yes,
it's always, it's a little bit. It's not a big hurdle, but it is a hurdle that you divide people from the ones who just complain to the ones who really want to see something happen.
Yeah, that's right.
And there's lots of them,
a lot of feedback. And we had three submitters from Raglan who spoke to their submissions, one online, two in the chambers, and then a lot of the ones online, who submitted
In writing.
So that's great to see that people are actually engaging with that. So our hearings are in early October. Not our hearings, our deliberations. So we hear those people who want to speak to their submissions, and then we go into the deliberations. We don't do that on the same day, and staff are still breaking down the data that we received from across the district, and there were people from out of the district who submitted as well, those who are interested
in freedom
camping.
About our area?
Yeah, about freedom camping,
for example.
Yeah, in general, because there are people who freedom camp, and they have an interest to come to Waikato district as well.
Yeah. So there are people who like to travel in the camper vans or house buses or whatever.
Yeah, so that so we're back into that, and obviously back into the long-term plan workshops.
So hold on, can I just ask, so I know that Dennis was going to present the community board perspective, which was that they're, rather than just banning freedom camping, there needed to be places to allow it, at least overnight, that were near facilities.
We're near facilities, toilet facilities.
That was that perspective. But what about the people, the other people who were submitting? Were they just saying, I don't want it on my street? Or
no, that if we're going to have freedom camping, that it needs to be properly monitored. And
so that's what other people are saying as well?
That's exactly right, from our community.
Yep.
One person who is on John Street, representing the residents near the dog run in Aro Park.
Yes.
About, how it was before when people were sort of open slather freedom camping in that area.
Yeah, there was a bit of controversy around there a couple of years ago.
And people actually going into using people's taps and hoses and, so people feeling really unsafe, and that actually in recent times with the signs that were put up saying no freedom parking, that it's they haven't had a problem with that, but they just wanted to express that they didn't want it to go back to the time
where it was worried.
Open slather. Yeah. A point that one person made was that it needed to be monitored and monitored well. If we're going to have a bylaw, then it has to be enforced.
Yeah.
And obviously putting people where there are facilities that don't encroach on the amenities for residents. So there was a lot of feedback. So that's really good feedback. And also another area was outside the bowling club because there has been an ongoing issue with freedom campers parking in the area outside the bowling club.
Yeah.
And so
For people who don't know, there's kind of room to park a camper van and not stick out into the road. So I think that attracts
and also those who are in the more what I call bongo vans that aren't necessarily self-contained. So aligning our bylaw with the changes to the Freedom Camping Act to require people to have a proper toilet on board. So that also will have an impact on the ability for our monitoring team to, tell people to move on if they haven't got the proper facilities on board. And then there was a question around, should we increase the number of nights they could stay in a community to 5? That wasn't supported very much, even by those who are in motorhomes. They said no, because you only really have enough capacity for water and waste for 3 days.
Yeah.
5 days seems too long. So that was really great. And another one was the distance that if people are required to move from one area, will they move 500 metres or more?
Oh, yeah.
And so a lot of feedback was, what's 500 metres? They'll just go from one place to the other. Should be at least a kilometre. So those are all of the things that, to take into consideration when we go to deliberate.
Right, that's quite a lot, actually.
There is a lot to consider, and you know, when you've got a lot of submitters, you have to break that down to, you know, you may be for or against freedom camping, but, you know, do we put people near where there are toilets and restrict the hours that they can stay? All of those sorts of things, because ultimately, at the end of the day, there's a Freedom Camping Act, you know, that supersedes what we have as a bylaw, so we have to work within those parameters to create that. So that's we've got back into the full swing of that. And, of course, the long-term plan workshops, which we had a workshop on Wednesday, which was around our internal teams within council and what they do.
So the long-term plan, folks, is the council's 10-year
plan.
It's the spending plan. It's the big one.
For forecasting. For the long-term plan, and we review it every 3 years of those 10 years because things change, things need tweaking. So, yeah.
Can I ask, there's so much to talk about with the long-term plan. What does the workshop consist of? Is that talking about issues that staff have highlighted? They're saying, like, you know, these things are run down and we're going to have to spend money on it. Is that kind of teaching about that?
No, not the internal one. It's more about what they're doing, whether it's digital technology or whether it's through managing our parks and reserves, our comms team. So that was what our Wednesday one was more about. So
keeping you guys up to date with all the stuff that's happening within council.
And what they anticipate, and our questions are you resourced enough? You know, what do we need to do? You know, our procurement, is that robust enough? Are we getting the best that we can get out of our contractors? How do we have oversight on the contracts? How do we ensure that we're doing the basics right? You know, so it's an opportunity for the elected members to really drill down on the details of how our internal teams within an organisation that has 400 plus staff, how we as the governors have oversight and understanding on what they do, because we have to make those decisions around if our communities want X, what are we going to need to change, or
if they want this and they don't want rates to go up, then something has to be cut.
Something has to give, you know. And what is it that we want to do? Is it the basics? Do the roading properly? You know, do the waste management properly? Do our wastewater properly, you know, because those all come at a cost, and then all of the other things that we provide, they come at a cost. So we have to do that balancing act, and you know, people are really struggling. And our, you know, in Raglan, you know, people are paying between $4,000 and $8,000 for their rates, so it's not insignificant.
Yeah, and the unfortunate thing is the issue. The cause of that is nothing to do with the councils. The cause of that is a little bit with central government dumping more stuff, and a little bit with, I'm just going to say, from my opinion, the neoliberal changes that started with Roger Douglas in 1984, that the councils are just getting squeezed and squeezed.
With less and less.
And yes, I know people complain that councils are incompetent, and there is certainly, that's possible, but the bigger picture is that it,
and I can see why people say that.
It makes it harder.
Yeah, and you know, when you see potholes that reoccur, you know, those are the things that
you're thinking of the bridge.
Yeah, you know, you can see those all down Whitley Street, you know, those types of things. And I absolutely get that, the frustrations, or, you know, something happens in our community and we weren't aware of it, whether it's me as a councillor or the community board, and it has a big impact on the perception.
So
of,
some
well, you guys,
yeah, staff come to do some physical work, and the community board and you guys didn't know about it. Yeah, and that, I can't remember what the issue was. There was something recently like that Dennis was a bit frustrated with.
You know, for example, the change of the fence around the airfield.
Yeah, that was it.
You know, so those types of things. So it is. So I can understand our communities feeling that way. And it's not just Raglan, it's all of our communities. You know, when I listen to my fellow councillors or go out into other communities, so it's understandable.
Yeah. Hey, I don't know if you'll know about this, and I forgot to ask Dennis about it last week, but the land-based sewage treatment, I did hear that there was a fair bit of opposition. A former community board member lives near where the proposed site is for the land-based sewage treatment, and generating a lot of opposition to it. This is my understanding in the grapevine. Is there any
Well, if
since you've been back, I know because you've only been back a week. So have you heard anything about where that project's at?
Well, if anyone wants any information, they can go on to the Waikato District Council website. And if you put in Raglan Wastewater Treatment, it'll come up with a page that actually has all of the up-to-date information about where we're at.
Okay.
And it is unfortunate that there are perhaps community members who are creating that sort of misinformation or division. But, you know, that's what you get in communities. But if people want to be informed, you're welcome to attend the Zoom Hui that we have once a month. The next one, I think, is on Thursday, the following Thursday at 7 o'clock in the evening. Anyone can Zoom into that.
It and could
that
be the 28th, I think.
Yeah, I think it's the 28th.
Yeah.
So anyone in our community, you can participate. So, or you can go back and watch the recorded videos of those. So if you want to participate, if you want to understand, then there's no barrier for you to engage in that. I actually didn't go to...
That was just my laptop, don't worry about it.
It was my hearing aid. It makes a funny noise just like that. And so you're more than welcome to participate. It's not closed to any one particular group.
And I think people may have felt like, because it's really clear that council and Watercare, who run the council service, are on board with the idea of doing this and have created money for it. So people might have thought that it's just going to happen. But maybe the community does understand that there still needs to, if they still really want it to happen, they still need to be visibly supportive,
at this time. And, you know, there's so many things to consider because there's wet weather events, you know, land-based discharge isn't always perfect. It's a complicated system, you know, and it comes at a pretty massive cost as well. So, you know, there's lots of things to consider. It's not straightforward as we're going to just put it onto land. You have to find the right sort of soil.
Well, first of all, you don't put it on the land as well. You put it
under the land. So, you know, but there's got to be other options for when the land is so sodden. What are those options? So in a simplistic way. So I really encourage you to go online and get that information because it's readily available. I'm not a wastewater expert, but happy to have a discussion with anyone. But I actually stood because part of when I first went on board is, you know, the discharge to the harbour.
At that time, that was a real issue in the community.
Wastewater discharge overflows that happened
constant.
That had a huge impact. And then we, of course, had the upgrades to our pumping stations with the telemetry and a whole raft of things. And we implemented the targeted rate to the upgrades for the wastewater for our wastewater treatment, which isn't insignificant. So,
on another issue, I think there was going to be a meeting at the campground about the erosion issue.
Yes, so we did that yesterday.
Did you? You were able to go. I was wondering if you might have been sick, but you had
no.
That.
So we had that yesterday morning. It was really good. So we met with staff. We talked about what the issues. You know, what are some of the solutions that we could look at? You know, is it putting back the groin? Is it putting in some hard walling along? And I think, as you go from, if you go over the walk bridge from town, on the right hand side, you'll notice that there's a small concrete wall that goes around by the skate park. You know, we talked about would we do a similar wall back toward and past the boat ramp because there's erosion right around there. It's not just to where the Utapa and the boat ramp is, but further towards the Air Force Bridge. So we agreed that it's probably a combination of those factors, a groin, some sort of hard walling perhaps, and then planting, back planting as well. But then what it comes down to is doing that plan and combining all three, but it comes at a cost. So that's something, you know, we'll have to look at what those costs are because it will then inform or go into the LTP. But, you know, can we wait that long? Because it might be 3 years before we see that. So what are the other options?
Someone can go and put a groin in under the cover of darkness. I've had quite a few interviews, and there was a science night about how to deal with that
erosion,
sort of thing. And definitely the removal of the old bridge, which had a groin effect, was, and Shaw Mead for 10 years has been trying to tell people, and the inevitable has happened. A lot of the talk about why we don't, like, they try not to put walls anymore.
That's exactly right. It's because you're
All they do is shift the problem.
And that's what we talked about yesterday as well.
Yeah.
I know it seems
like it's a good idea, but
at Papahua,
the interconnected nature of everything in the world, it just.
And the impacts of climate change, regardless if people believe it or not. So Ben Wolf, one of our staff, he's an environment, you know, he works in the environment part of our business. And, you know, we have to acknowledge that it's a really dynamic environment. So what we put in there may only be for 20, 50 years. But we also have to look at, you know, the consideration of the retreat for the camp in the future. But that is, the camp is one of our bigger businesses in Raglan. You know, it welcomes, you know, up to 5,500 visitors in a busy month. So it's a major draw card for the Raglan economy. You know, we've got to consider many factors in that. And not only is it an attractive for the camp, but, you know, we could have 2,000 or 3,000 people visiting the beach in a day. That's just one beach. And then, of course, we've got Ngaranui, then we've got Manu Bay. So those are, you know, they're key parts of our tourism and business economy for this community. So those are considerations that we have to look at as well.
Mm. Okay. Well, folks, we'll be talking to our councillor, Lisa Thompson, back in town.
Oh, yeah, and
a few weeks away.
And I just wanted to also just encourage people. I went to the Tauticura election workshop on Sunday, which was fantastic actually, and talking about how to vote, going you know, understanding that you actually get two votes, one for the party vote, one for your candidate, and also we broke down the major parties, Te Māori Party, Green Party, Labour, National and ACT, under a number, about 12 or 15 headings of their policies and who does what. That was really fascinating. And my 20-year-old son on Saturday with his friend Sam, new voters, we sat at the kitchen table and I think he did the vote compass, and we had lots of really robust discussions around voting and why you should vote and student loans and should prisoners vote, all of those sorts of things. And my son came out with 98% alignment with the Māori Party. So, you know, so that was really good discussion that we had, and we, you know, weren't necessarily aligned and everything, but, you know, opening up that discussion. So if you are a parent or a grandparent, have those discussions with young people around you, because
how can they find that vote compass?
You just Google it.
Okay.
Go into Google, and you could go to Tauticura, Tauricura.
I had to write it down recently.
NZ, and they've got a lot of information on there, or even I don't think Vote New Zealand has it, because they have to be impartial. But even if you just Google, there's a number of online mechanisms to help you through the who's who in the zoo.
I think sometimes people are a little bit surprised when they see what the policies are and what each party has for their policy. It doesn't match what the perception was.
That's exactly right, and I think that's key for people too. If you have an inquiring mind, and you have an idea of what sort of society you want to live in, then I highly recommend and encourage people to be inquiring, and, you know, look at what each party stands for and what their policies are, rather than just look at what may be on offer. Do a bit of work to inform yourself, and really encourage those young people around you who are voting age to get out and take action.
And what are you, as councillor, what are you off to next?
I'm actually going out to Te Mata School for more tako tako marae, just to support the school, and also, yeah, it's the Western Cluster Kapa Haka.
Yes.
For the Western Cluster for the junior school, so Raglan Area School, Te Mata's hosting it, Tuku Waititina, and all the schools in the Western Cluster, Whatawhata, for example, they are all there at Timata School this morning. So I'm heading out there just to support our kaumātua who are going to be there.
Awesome. Thanks for coming in, Lisa.
Thanks, Aaron.
All right, folks, we're going to have a little break, and I guess I got some music lined up after this, and I can go back to writing up the news bulletin I was going to do.